dive into my first ever human-centered experience trends report. I've gathered the most impactful developments shaping our industry this quarter. Each insight reflects my personal observations and research in this fascinating field. I hope you find value in these curated trends and perspectives. Your feedback means a lot to me. Please don't hesitate to share your thoughts as I continue this journey.
Hey, have you ever gotten that feeling lately, like your time online, the internet, it just feels different.
Different, yeah. Maybe not quite what it once was.
Exactly. Like, the magic sort of faded and it's become, well, something else.
That's a feeling a lot of people seem to be noticing, actually.
Right. And that's really what we're digging into today. We've been looking at some really interesting perspectives. Some are quite nostalgic, looking back at the early web.
Mm-hmm. The good old days.
Yeah, exactly. And then there are some pretty blunt takes on what it's like now. And also some data, really striking data, about how AI is getting involved.
And when you kind of piece all that together,
it paints this picture, right? That the internet we sort of grew up with, that open web, maybe it's not just changing. Maybe it's quietly disappearing.
So the plan for this deep dive really is to unpack what these different sources are saying. What's the argument here?
Yeah, what are the signs they point to? And crucially, what does it actually mean for, you know, us, for our everyday experience online?
Okay, so maybe let's start with that nostalgia piece, that idea of the earlier internet.
Good idea. There's definitely a sense of looking back fondly in some of this stuff.
Absolutely. And there's this piece by Antires, The Ghost of the Old Web. It really nails that feeling.
Yeah, I read that one. Very evocative.
He talks about, you know, a time when the internet just felt so much more personal, like it was a collection of individual expressions.
Right. Not like the big platforms we have now.
Exactly. Not the sort of centralized thing we mostly experience today. He mentions things like personal websites. Remember those?
Oh, yeah. And independent blogs. It felt like you were like stumbling into someone's personal corner of the web.
Totally full of their specific interests, their knowledge. There was that sense of discovery. Serendipity, almost.
Clicking links, seeing where you ended up.
Yeah.
It was an adventure sometimes.
And compare that to now. So much of what we see and do online is filtered through these huge platforms.
The walled gardens, he calls them.
Right. And they've sort of become the gatekeepers, haven't they?
Yeah.
Controlling so much of the information flow.
Which means it's less about that kind of open exploring.
Yeah, and more about just navigating inside the walls they've built. And this concentration of power, it doesn't just like limit what you see.
No, it also means their priorities kind of take over, right? The platform's goal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Often overshadowing what the user might actually want or need.
And you can see how that works. I mean, the algorithms are constantly deciding what pops up in your feed.
Uh-huh. And it's all optimized for keeping you scrolling, keeping you clicking.
Yeah, engagement and ultimately ad revenue. It really does feel like the focus has shifted
away from maybe genuine content or real connection
towards just maximizing those metrics, keeping eyeballs on the screen.
And that shift, it has consequences. That space for like individual creativity,
those quirky personal sites, the different voices from independent blogs,
they get harder to find, right? They're less visible when everything's dominated by these massive commercial players.
It's like the original idea, that sort of decentralized network of knowledge.
Yeah, the thing that made it exciting, it feels like it's being, well, squeezed out.
Which honestly brings us pretty neatly to how using the internet actually feels right now.
Mm-hmm. The day-to-day experience.
And sometimes, let's be real, it feels pretty frustrating. One of the pieces we looked at just calls it like it is, the internet is unusable.
Wow, okay. Strong title.
It is, but it taps into that sense of daily annoyance a lot of us probably feel.
It describes the modern web as almost overwhelming, intrusive.
Cacophony was the word used, and it fits, doesn't it?
It really does. You load a page and bam, pop-ups asking for your email.
Or those cookie banners everywhere, the ones where accept all is huge and bright, but manage options is tiny and gray.
Ugh, yeah. And auto-playing videos. It's just sensory overload sometimes.
You feel like you're constantly fighting things off just to read an article or watch a video.
And it's not just the clutter, is it? There's also this feeling of being manipulated somehow.
Yeah, those dark patterns, the sneaky designs that trick you into clicking stuff or make it almost impossible to cancel a subscription.
Right. It adds to this feeling that you're constantly being nudged or pushed around.
And then you've got the algorithmic feeds, social media, news sites.
Oh, yeah. designed to just keep you hooked, keep you scrolling.
And what do they often prioritize? Stuff that's like sensational, outrageous.
Things that get a quick reaction, basically. Not necessarily quality or relevance to you.
Exactly. They show you more of what keeps other people clicking, which can lead you down these weird rabbit holes.
According to those echo chambers, right? Where you only see stuff that confirms what you already think.
Yeah. Which is a pretty big change from how people originally imagined the internet.
Definitely. That early vision was all about empowerment, wasn't it? Access to information, connecting with people.
A tool for learning and discovery.
And now, it often feels more like this constant fight for your attention, where your own control is kind of secondary.
Secondary to growth, monetization.
Yeah. So you've got this fading memory of a more open web and this sort of frustrating present-day experience.
Okay, so layer onto that another major shift. AI. Artificial intelligence.
Right. And its impact seems to be growing incredibly fast. This Adobe Analytics report.
Yeah.
The numbers are pretty staggering.
Staggering is the word. A 1,200% jump in traffic to U.S. retail sites just from generative AI sources in 1 year.
1,200%.
Yeah.
That's not just incremental change. That's a huge shift.
It signals something fundamental is changing in how we find things online, how commerce works.
It suggests that maybe algorithms, more than our own like curiosity, are going to shape what we see and buy.
Yeah. And it's not just AI working quietly in the background anymore, is it?
No, it's becoming much more active, like those AI shopping assistants, chatbots helping you find stuff.
AI is becoming this active go-between in our online interactions.
Which, you know, raises some big questions. This idea of increased algorithmic mediation.
What do you mean by mediation exactly?
Well, if AI is doing more of the browsing for us, finding products, maybe even researching topics, what does that do to our own ability to explore, our own agency?
Right. Are we just sort of outsourcing our curiosity to the machines?
Potentially. And if AI is increasingly influencing what we buy, what information we take in?
How does that change our whole relationship with the internet? It feels like another step away from that direct human-driven exploration of the early web.
Exactly. So you see these trends.
Yeah.
The move away from the decentralized web.
Yeah.
The degraded user experience.
And now this explosion of AI shaping traffic and interaction.
They aren't really separate things, are they? They seem to be converging, maybe even reinforcing each other.
Creating this fundamentally different online world.
Yeah. So if you put it all together, the argument seems to be that the internet is really transforming.
From that open, maybe slightly chaotic space for discovery and connection.
Into something much more controlled, commercialized. And heavily curated by algorithms.
That sums it up pretty well, I think.
And the potential consequences of that transformation, they seem pretty widespread. They could affect us in a lot of different ways.
For individuals like you and me, it sounds like, well, maybe more frustration.
More ads, more manipulation, maybe feeling more trapped in those filter bubbles.
Yeah, and maybe making it even harder to find like genuinely authentic information or to have real meaningful connections when so much is filtered or even AI generated.
It's a concern. And for businesses, sure, there are opportunities with AI for driving traffic.
But it also raises ethical questions, right, about how they use it. Are they really serving customers or just optimizing for the algorithm?
That's a key tension. And there's also the risk of, you know, even more power getting concentrated in the hands of the big companies developing these AI platforms.
Good point. And then zooming out even further, what about society?
Yeah, the bigger picture implications. If we're all increasingly getting fed specific curated content streams.
And our interactions are mediated by AI.
What does that do to things like critical thinking, independent thought, our ability to have informed discussions?
It definitely makes you wonder, is the convenience we get from these platforms worth potentially losing that sense of genuine discovery or independent thought?
These are really the crucial questions, aren't they? The sources we dove into suggest that the internet, in its original form, really is fading.
Yeah. Understanding how these trends fit together helps you see just how big this change really is.
So the main takeaway here feels pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
The internet we knew, that kind of exciting frontier, it's probably on its way out.
And like technology always changes, that's inevitable. But it feels really vital to stop and think critically about what this particular evolution means for us.
Absolutely. What does that ghost of the old web actually teach us? What did we value about it?
Individual voices, decentralized connection. Serendipity.
Maybe. And as AI becomes more and more embedded in everything, how do we try and steer things towards a future internet that still feels, well, human-centered? That values our autonomy.
really important things to think about. Thanks for hashing this all out.
Yeah, likewise. It's a lot to process.
It really is. So maybe for everyone listening, as you're browsing this week, just take a moment, notice your own experience. Do you see these trends playing out?
Yeah, what bits of the old web, if any, do you actually miss?
How is AI already changing how you interact online? And maybe the biggest question, what does a better, more human-centered internet even look like to you? Definitely some food for thought there. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, you've sent us some really thought-provoking material this time, a set of articles really peeling back the layers on what's actually happening with AI right now.
Yeah, moving beyond the hype a bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Forget the robot uprisings for a minute. We're going straight into the nitty-gritty.
Okay.
We're looking at how AI is hitting our digital plumbing, you know, the infrastructure, also its fundamental limits, the biases baked into it.
Right, the data it learns from.
Our growing reliance, maybe over-reliance, and, well, the big question, what it all means for us, for humans.
Absolutely. I think it's a really crucial moment to step back from the initial, maybe, excitement.
Yeah.
And really analyze the practical realities
yeah.
and the potential downsides that these sources you sent are highlighting.
So the mission for this deep dive
mm-hmm.
is to sort of weave together these threads from these different angles, understand how these challenges aren't just separate problems.
No, they're deeply interconnected. And, you know, there are some surprising tensions that pop up when you look at that bigger picture.
Okay, so let's unpack this, starting with something maybe a bit unexpected. The sheer pressure AI is putting on the internet's infrastructure.
Yeah, the plumbing, as you called it.
One of your sources, that Ars Technica report, really shone a light on this.
It did. What's kind of wild here is just how hungry modern AI models are for data. Voracious, really.
Right.
They weren't like us casually browsing. They're more like, I don't know, digital vacuum cleaners just constantly sucking up info to learn.
Huh. Digital vacuum cleaners. I like that.
And that piece detailed how this relentless data hoovering is causing a massive spike in internet traffic, specifically from AI crawlers.
So we're talking the actual servers, the data centers, the cables.
A whole network, yeah. All the stuff that powers our digital world. And AI's insatiable appetite for data is just putting a huge strain on all of it.
And this isn't just like a theoretical, oh, things might slow down problem, is it?
Not at all.
The consequences are already hitting. It's not just your favorite site loading a bit slower.
No, we're seeing strained server capacities, definitely.
Yeah.
But also, and this is pretty incredible, website owners actually blocking traffic from entire countries.
Wow. Just to keep their sites online?
Just to manage the load from the AI traffic, yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine trying to get info online and finding, I don't know, all of France blocked because of AI crawlers.
That really brings home the scale, doesn't it?
It really does. And it highlights this fundamental tension, I think. AI development needs vast amounts of data the way it's currently done.
Right.
But that very need is disrupting and maybe even fragmenting the digital ecosystem we all depend on.
It almost makes you wonder if the internet's becoming a kind of resource battleground.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
A battleground between AI's needs and, well, human users needing access and bandwidth.
It's a sobering thought, definitely. Okay, so shifting focus a bit from the pipes of the internet to the AI models themselves. Another source you shared, I think it was a Medium article, talked about this key difference, probabilistic versus deterministic AI.
Yes, and that distinction is really key to understanding some of the inherent limitations we're bumping up against.
Explain that a little. Deterministic versus probabilistic.
Sure. So many of the really cutting edge AI models today, they operate on probabilities. Think of it like this. Instead of knowing why something is true, the AI just recognizes patterns where it's usually true in the data it saw.
Okay, pattern matching.
Exactly. Which is incredibly powerful for predicting things or generating stuff.
Yeah.
But it's fundamentally different from how, you know, a human understands things through cause and effect reasoning.
So deterministic is like 1 + 1 always equals 2 every single time.
Precisely. Specific input, same output, always. But probabilistic AI, it has this element of randomness built in. It allows it to be creative, generate novel text or images.
Yeah.
But it also means the outputs aren't always consistent
or
even correct.
Which leads us right into this slightly unsettling thing about AI hallucinations. The NN Group article you sent really dug into this. And just for listeners, these aren't like fun, tricky visions.
No, not at all.
It's when AI just confidently makes stuff up. False information, fake facts, totally nonsensical outputs.
Exactly that. It could be a chatbot confidently describing a historical event that just never happened.
Right.
Or an image generator creating something bizarre, like a person with three arms, but presenting it as if it's normal.
Because it doesn't know it's wrong.
It doesn't know anything in the human sense.
Yeah.
It's working with statistical probabilities, learned patterns from its data. And sometimes those patterns lead to confidently incorrect and, yeah, often quite strange results.
And the impact that has on user trust. Well, it's got to be significant, right?
Huge. If you can't consistently rely on an AI for accurate information, its value as a reliable tool just plummets.
Especially for important things. You wouldn't want it giving medical advice or financial planning if it might just hallucinate.
Absolutely not. It raises really serious questions about depending on AI as a source of truth, particularly in critical areas.
It feels like maybe we need a sort of trust but verify approach. But verification is hard when the AI sounds so convincing.
It does. It raises this question. If these probabilistic systems are inherently prone to just being wrong sometimes, what safeguards do we need? How do we build up a healthy skepticism?
Yeah, how do we critically evaluate AI content without just dismissing it all or blindly accepting it, especially as it gets woven more into daily life?
It's a tricky balance. We definitely need to approach a lot of AI-generated stuff with a significant dose of caution right now.
Okay, let's pivot again. We've talked infrastructure, reliability.
Right.
What about us, the humans using it?
Right.
The convenience AI offers is amazing, but could there be a hidden cost? One of the UXdesign.cc articles brought up E.M. Forster's old story, The Machine Stops.
Ah, yes. Such a prescient story.
It paints a pretty disturbing picture, doesn't it? A future where humanity is just completely dependent on technology.
The parallels are quite striking, I think. Forster's vision, it's this society where people rely entirely on the machine for everything.
Everything, like food, information.
Everything. Information, communication, sustenance. And because of that total reliance, they've lost their capacity for independent thought, for real human connection, even basic survival skills outside the machine.
Wow.
And the article uses this as a really powerful cautionary tale as we integrate AI more and more deeply into our own lives.
And it's not hard to see how that drift could happen, is it? It's insidious, maybe.
How so?
Well, think about all the little tasks we might increasingly just offload to AI. Remembering facts, navigating somewhere new, maybe even drafting emails or reports, creative stuff.
Right. Using GPS instead of learning a route, or asking a chatbot instead of recalling information.
Exactly. And these tools are incredibly helpful, don't get me wrong, super efficient. But what happens to our own abilities if we lean on them so much that those mental muscles start to atrophy?
That's the core concern, isn't it? This potential decline in essential human skills.
Have you ever, like, reached for your phone instantly instead of even trying to remember a fact first? I know I have.
We all probably have. And that's the subtle shift. If we don't need to actively memorize things because AI has the answer instantly, do our memory capabilities weaken?
Or if we always use AI for directions, do we lose that innate sense of direction, spatial awareness?
Or creative skills.
Mm-hmm.
If AI writes the first draft or generates the music or creates the art, does our own capacity for innovation, for original thought, start to diminish?
It feels like a risk of, I don't know, intellectual laziness or maybe emotional stagnation too.
Stagnation through overdependence. We gain convenience, sure, efficiencies in the short term, but what's the long-term cost to our cognitive toolkit? Our ability to think for ourselves, solve problems independently.
It's a trade-off we really need to be consciously thinking about.
Precisely. The convenience is tempting, it's undeniable, but we have to critically ask if that convenience comes at the expense of our own capabilities, our own sense of agency in the world.
Okay, so let's try and pull these threads together then. We've got the strained infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. The plumbing.
The inherent unreliability, the hallucinations.
The probabilistic nature.
The potential for overdependence, maybe losing our own skills.
The machine stop scenario.
It all points towards some really big, broad implications for, well, human flourishing, right? There is another UXdesign.cc article that really tackled this bigger picture.
Yes, absolutely. When you connect all these dots, you start to see how these issues aren't isolated. They could collectively impact our well-being, the whole fabric of society.
How so? What's the connection?
Well, think about it.
Hmm.
If our digital commons, the internet, is strained and maybe less accessible, if we can't always trust the information AI gives us, and if we become overly reliant on these potentially unreliable systems, maybe even losing skills, What kind of future are we actually building?
Yeah, when you put it like that, it doesn't sound particularly utopian if we're not careful.
Right. There's a genuine concern, I think, that this tech, instead of just empowering us, could inadvertently undermine things we value, our sense of purpose, maybe, our connection with others, our autonomy.
And you mentioned something else about AI simplifying things.
Yeah, that's another angle. Current AI often works by finding patterns, right? Which means reducing complex human experiences, emotions, culture, nuance, down to data points.
Oversimplifying us.
Potentially, yeah. That approach is powerful for certain tasks, but it can totally miss the richness, the complexity, the individuality that makes us human. Combine that oversimplification with worries about jobs being displaced.
Ah, the job displacement concern.
Right. It contributes to this growing unease about the future of work and maybe the fundamental value we place on human skills and contributions versus machine efficiency.
So, boiling this whole deep dive down, we've uncovered some really critical and interconnected downsides to AI's current trajectory.
Definitely.
This isn't just about minor glitches. We're talking potential serious strain on internet infrastructure,
yeah.
A fundamental level of unreliability built into how many AI systems work.
The probabilistic part, yeah.
Very real risks of becoming overdependent, maybe de-skilled, and ultimately some pretty profound questions about the long-term impact on us, on human flourishing, if we don't navigate this really carefully.
Exactly. These aren't abstract worries for the future. They are significant unfolding issues right now. They demand our attention, a critical eye, and a proactive, thoughtful approach.
Yeah, the sources you shared really make it clear. The conversation around AI needs to mature, doesn't it? Beyond just, wow, look what it can do.
Absolutely. We need to seriously grapple with these emerging downsides, not just celebrate the potential benefits.
And it really hammers home the need for a truly human-centered approach to developing AI.
Couldn't agree more.
It can't just be about pushing the tech forward for its own sake.
Yeah.
It has to be about how these incredibly powerful tools can genuinely serve and enhance the human experience.
Yeah, without accidentally eroding the very things that make us, well, us.
Exactly. Which brings us to a final thought, maybe for you, the listener, to chew on. Considering all these interconnected downsides, we've talked through the infrastructure strain, the unreliability, the dependence, the bigger societal questions. How can we, individually and collectively, actually steer AI development?
How do we guide it proactively?
Yeah. How do we make sure it genuinely enhances, rather than potentially unravels, the richness and complexity of human life?
That is definitely a question worth some deep thought.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping straight into something pretty massive. Artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it's really moved beyond just, you know, sci-fi dreams.
Totally. It's right here, right now. In your phone, your newsfeed, how you get recommendations.
Even how images or text get generated. AI is just, well, it's weaving itself into everything.
Exactly. So our mission for this deep dive is to really unpack that. How is all this AI actually affecting the way we think?
We've got some interesting angles on this. We looked at articles from acusdesign.cc, ucasmatters.com, and a paper from OpenAI, too. Lots to dig into.
Right. And it's kind of this double-edged sword idea, isn't it? There's the amazing convenience, the power AI gives us. It's undeniable.
But then there's the other side, the potential risks, how it might affect our own cognitive abilities, our well-being.
Which we really need to explore. So maybe let's start with the most obvious thing, just how convenient AI makes everything.
Yeah, that's a great place to kick off. One of the UX design pieces, the cognitive cost of convenience, really nails this. AI is fantastic at smoothing things out, right?
Oh, definitely.
Removing friction, taking over tasks that used to need, well, our effort.
Like spell check, grammar suggestions.
Autofill for passwords.
Yeah.
It just makes digital life feel easier.
And that flows right into this concept of cognitive offloading, which another UX design article gets into. It's like we're increasingly outsourcing bits of our thinking, aren't we? Memory, calculations, maybe even small decisions.
We are. It's efficient, you see. Why spend mental energy recalling a fact when your phone can tell you instantly?
Or doing mental math.
Exactly. Or figuring out the best route when an app does it for you. It frees up mental bandwidth, which, you know, sounds good on the surface.
Oh, okay. Here's the potentially tricky part. I keep thinking of that analogy, like muscles, if you stop using them.
In atrophy.
Yeah. Could that be happening with our brains? If we constantly lean on AI for directions, for remembering stuff, for solving little problems, are we letting those mental muscles get weaker?
That's the core concern, isn't it? This outsourcing, well, super convenient right now might lead to a gradual, subtle erosion of our own abilities over time.
So you might find yourself, I don't know, struggling more with recall. We're less confident tackling a problem from scratch.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
It's something to be mindful of.
It is a bit sobering.
Yeah.
And it connects to another angle from that UxDesign article on dopamine addiction. The way AI delivers these easy answers, it can actually feel good.
Oh, absolutely. That's the dopamine loop kicking in. Instant gratification.
Like when you get that perfect recommendation. Or a chatbot just gives you the exact answer you needed.
Yeah. That little rush of dopamine reinforces the behavior. It makes you want to go back for more of that effortless solution.
You see it with social media feeds curated by AI, right?
Yeah.
Endless scrolling because it knows what you like.
Or just asking a voice assistant instead of trying to remember something yourself. It's so easy, so rewarding in that moment.
And the risk there, I suppose, is becoming over-reliant.
Exactly. If you keep getting that quick dopamine hit from AI doing the work, your own intrinsic motivation to put in the mental effort might fade.
Leading to maybe like cognitive complacency, always taking the easy AI route.
It's a possibility. Always choosing the path of least resistance because AI pays it so nicely.
Hmm. Okay, that paints a slightly worrying picture, but surely it's not all doom and gloom. Our sources also talked about AI potentially being helpful, augmenting us.
Yes, definitely. And that's a really important counterpoint. The Ux Manners article, Designing AI for Human Expertise, focuses squarely on this.
Okay.
It argues strongly that AI can be designed not to replace us, but to actually enhance our expertise. To make us better.
How does that work then? Instead of doing the thinking for us.
It acts more like an intelligent partner. It provides support, maybe offers insights that deepen your understanding, helps you build mastery.
Ah, so it's about the design of the AI system.
Crucially, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine an AI that doesn't just give you the answer, but maybe guides you through the process of finding it.
Or prompts you to think differently. Offers alternative perspectives you hadn't considered.
Exactly. That's where the real potential for genuine cognitive enhancement lies. It guides, prompts, supports reflection.
So the key is keeping human agency front and center, making sure the AI doesn't just offer shortcuts that stop us from actually learning or retaining the skill.
That's precisely it. The design needs to encourage active engagement from the user. Not passive reception.
So AI becomes a tool to build our skills, not just bypass them.
Right. A catalyst for deeper understanding, ideally.
Now, the OpenAI paper added another layer, didn't it? The whole emotional side of interacting with AI.
Yes, and that's fascinating. It's not just a purely logical, transactional thing. People have real emotional responses to AI.
Like what?
Well, it ranges. Some feel a real connection, almost like companionship. Others might feel frustration or become quite dependent. And a key finding was that users often feel like they're collaborating with the AI. They see it as a helpful, knowledgeable partner.
I can see that. When an AI tool really helps you nail something, it can feel like teamwork, like you achieved it together.
Mm-hmm. But that feeling, that emotional connection, while positive in some ways, can also feed into that over-reliance risk we talked about.
Ah, right. Because you trust it, you feel comfortable with it.
You might lean on it more and more, maybe even for simple things you can easily do yourself, potentially hindering your own development without realizing it.
So it's not just convenience or dopamine, but this sense of partnership that could also subtly lead to dependency. That's a really key insight.
It is. Understanding that emotional landscape is critical to grasping the full picture of AI's cognitive impact.
Mm-hmm.
It shapes how we use these tools.
Okay, so pulling all these threads together, it really feels like there's no simple good or bad answer here, is there?
Not at all. It's incredibly nuanced. We have to hold both sides in mind.
The amazing convenience, the power that's real.
Absolutely. Huge potential benefits. But we also have to be aware of the risks, the cognitive offloading, those addictive reward loops, the potential erosion of our skills if we're not careful.
And it seems like so much comes down to, well, intentionality. Both in how AI is designed and how we choose to use it.
That seems to be the crux of it. We should be looking for and encouraging AI that acts as that partner, that augments our expertise.
Rather than just taking over.
Right. AI is a tool to enhance our cognitive abilities, not a crutch that replaces them.
And keeping that emotional dimension in mind is vital for, you know, our overall well-being and growth, too.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's about finding that balance, using these powerful tools consciously.
So the future isn't set in stone. It's about the choices we make, individually and collectively, and how we integrate AI into our lives and our thinking.
Precisely. We are actively shaping that future with how we engage right now.
Well, this has been really illuminating. It's clear AI's impact on how we think is complex, and it's a conversation we definitely need to keep having.
For sure. As the technology evolves, so will its effects, and our understanding needs to keep pace.
So maybe a final thought for everyone listening. As you go about your day, just notice, pay attention to the subtle ways AI might already be shaping your cognitive habits.
Yeah, what are you choosing to offload? What are you actively engaging?
And how can you make sure you're strengthening your own mental muscles in this this rapidly changing world? Something to really mull over.
Okay, so let's dive in. AI, it's making art now. And I mean, not just, you know, editing photos, it's generating completely new stuff.
It really is. It feels like it's gone beyond just being another tool, hasn't it?
Totally. It feels like a fundamental challenge to how we think about art, about creativity itself, and even who gets to call themselves an artist.
Yeah, and the sources we've looked at for this deep dive, they really frame this through posthumanism, which is a fascinating angle.
It is, and the speed of this. It's kind of mind-blowing. We've jumped from like theory to actual algorithms, creating these really complex, sometimes really compelling images.
Absolutely. And like you said, it's not just tech. It's poking at some really basic ideas we hold about, you know, where art comes from.
Exactly. So for this deep dive, that's our mission, really, to get to grips with these big questions. We've got readings looking at the design process, that whole debate about human creativity. Mm-hmm. Is it dead? Is it changing?
Right. And how AI art might actually be seen as a postmodern. Which is an interesting take.
Definitely. And wrapping it all up with that posthumanist view.
Yeah.
We want to give everyone listening a clear way to think about this without getting totally lost in, you know, academic speak.
Yeah, because posthumanism, essentially, it just asks us to maybe think beyond only the human perspective, right? Mm-hmm. To consider technology, other non-human things as part of the picture.
Precisely. So for you listening, you're probably seeing these images, hearing the buzz. We just want to offer a framework for thinking about what's really going on underneath. It's more than just cool pictures.
It's about how we see ourselves, our own creative spark in this new landscape.
Okay, so first up, this idea of the design process and crucially, authorship. Who's the author?
Yeah, that's a big one.
One of our sources, whose design process goes right at it. It forces you to ask, okay, if an algorithm makes something that looks and feels like art, who created it?
Is it the programmer?
Or the person who curated the data it learned from?
Well,
or can the AI itself claim some kind of authorship? It sounds weird, but...
Yeah, well, it bumps up against our usual idea of intent, doesn't it? We normally think of an author having a specific vision, a conscious goal.
Right, a human mind driving it.
Is that same kind of deliberate intention there with an algorithm? Or is it something else entirely, a different kind of process?
And that's where the collective consciousness piece offers a really useful perspective. It frames AI less as a replacement and more like a powerful collaborator.
Okay, like an assistant.
Kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. Imagine it handling the tedious stuff, maybe generating thousands of color variations or optimizing layouts, things that take humans ages.
Uh-huh. And it can also presumably generate completely novel ideas, things a human might not stumble upon.
Exactly. Unexpected directions. It reminds me a bit of, you know, other big tech shifts in art, like photography.
Right. Photography didn't kill painting. It changed it. It opened up new possibilities. The printing press, same thing.
So maybe this isn't about AI taking over, but about augmenting human creativity, allowing us to do things we couldn't before.
It suggests the design process becomes more interactive.
You know, like a conversation.
Yeah.
The human sets the direction, maybe the core idea.
Yeah.
And the AI responds, offers variations, pushes back even. It's less linear, more fluid.
A dynamic interplay. So boundaries blur between human input and algorithmic output.
Which I find, well, it's interesting. There's that slight unease maybe.
Yeah.
Losing a bit of control, but also huge potential. Right.
It leads straight into that core tension by like, what is human creativity now? That source. Is this the death or dawn of human creativity? The title says it all, really.
It really does capture the split.
On one side, you have the fear, the worry that if AI can mimic and synthesize art so well, does that devalue human effort?
Yeah, what about the years of practice, the skill, the artist's unique vision, the, you know, the struggle that often goes into making art?
Does the sheer speed and volume of AI output somehow cheapen the human contribution? That's the anxiety.
But then the flip side.
Yeah.
The dawn part of the title, AI as a catalyst.
Precisely. The idea that this isn't an ending, but a new beginning, a tool to break through limitations.
How so? Like overcoming creative blocks?
Maybe. or rapidly touching ideas that would take weeks manually, exploring aesthetic avenues you'd never have considered because the AI suggests them, it could push art into totally new territories.
Beyond our own sort of human biases and limitations, even.
Potentially, yes. Which forces that really fundamental question you raised earlier.
Is creativity only human? Can it only come from consciousness, from a biological brain?
Or could something we call creativity emerge from these incredibly complex algorithmic processes, even without consciousness as we understand it?
If an AI creates something genuinely novel, something moving, what does that mean? Do we need a bigger definition of creative?
It's a huge philosophical question, because if creativity is defined by human origin, AI art is always secondary, imitation.
But if we define it by the output, its novelty, its impact, its ability to communicate,
then maybe, just maybe, algorithms can participate in that creative space, which is a radical thought for many.
It really is. And this connects, surprisingly well perhaps, to postmodernism. One source flat out argues AI-generated art is postmodern art.
Okay, unpack that. How does AI art fit into postmodernism?
Well, think about core postmodern ideas like appropriation, taking existing things and recontextualizing them. Pastiche mixing styles, questioning originality.
Right, the breakdown of the grand narratives, the rejection of the sole genius creator.
Exactly. And AI art does this almost by definition.
Mm-hmm.
It's trained on massive data sets of existing art. It learns styles, motifs, techniques.
And then it remixes them, combines them, references them constantly.
Yeah. It challenges that old romantic idea of the artist pulling something totally original out of thin air. The AI is inherently referential.
So the algorithm itself is kind of the ultimate postmodern appropriator, drawing on everything, endlessly reconfiguring.
You could see it that way. Almost like it reflects our current digital culture, you know? Everything's a remix, everything's sampled, information is constantly flowing and being reshaped.
It feels less like an alien invasion in the art world and more like a reflection of the digital soup we're already swimming in.
That's a good way to put it. But, like the source material notes, not everyone agrees with slapping the postmodern label on it.
What's the pushback?
A lot of it comes down to intent again. Traditional postmodern art, even when it's playful or deconstructive, usually has some kind of critical edge, right? A conceptual point it's making.
Uh-huh. A commentary.
And the argument is, does AI have that? Is it making a critique? Or is it just pattern matching and generating based on its training without that layer of conscious critical intent?
That's a key distinction. Is it deliberate commentary or just sophisticated mimicry that happens to align with postmodern aesthetics?
Yeah. And that brings us right back around to posthumanism, which kind of provides the philosophical grounding for grappling with these questions.
Because posthumanism asks us to question that human-centered viewpoint.
Right. To decenter the human, basically. To stop assuming humans are the only source of intelligence, agency, or even creativity. And AI art is a perfect test case for this.
If these non-human systems, these algorithms, can create works that resonate with us aesthetically, that stimulate us intellectually, does that force us to admit creativity isn't exclusively human?
It definitely challenges our anthropocentric bias, that deep-down assumption that anything truly valuable, especially art, must come from a person.
Posthumanism opens the door to thinking about creativity as potentially emerging from complex systems, whether they're biological like us or technological like AI.
It's not about saying AI is better than human art, is it?
Not at all. It's not devaluing human creativity. It's more about expanding the definition, acknowledging that creative potential might be distributed more widely than we thought.
Recognizing that humans and technology are increasingly tangled up. And maybe new kinds of creativity arise from that entanglement.
Exactly. A more inclusive, maybe more realistic view of how creation happens now.
So if that's the case, what's left for the human artist? If AI can generate images, what's the human role going forward? Are we obsolete?
I really don't think so. But the roles are definitely shifting. Humans become crucial in different ways. Think about curation.
Okay, like selecting the good stuff.
Precisely. AI can generate endlessly, but humans provide the taste, the judgment, deciding which outputs are meaningful, interesting, worth developing further. We filter the noise.
And we're still the ones providing the initial spark, often, the prompters.
Absolutely. Guiding the AI, setting the direction, framing the exploration with our intentions, our questions, our visions. The AI might be the engine, but we're often still steering.
And maybe the most important role, providing the interpretation. the context.
I think so.
Yeah.
We bring our lived experience, our emotions, our understanding of culture and history to the table.
Right.
We're the ones who ultimately decide what an AI-generated piece means, how it connects to human concerns.
An algorithm can't really replicate that depth of understanding, that emotional resonance, at least not yet.
So it points towards collaboration, augmentation.
Yeah, it feels much more like a partnership. Humans and AI working together, leveraging each other's strengths. Not replacement, but a new kind of creative synergy.
But this synergy, this collaboration, it throws up some serious ethical and philosophical hurdles, especially through that posthumanist lens we keep mentioning.
For sure. Like, who owns the copyright to something an AI creates?
Good question. Is it the user who prompted it? The company that built the AI? Is the AI itself a potential rights holder in some future legal framework? It's messy.
And how do we value things? Do we value the painstaking human skill less now that an algorithm can produce something visually similar in seconds?
It forces us to think about what we actually value in art. Is it the effort, the human touch, the story behind it?
Or is it purely the final product, its ability to make us feel something, think something new, challenge our perceptions, regardless of whether a human or an algorithm made it?
That's the fundamental question AI art puts squarely in front of us, isn't it?
Right.
What defines art itself, its origin, or its impact?
There are no easy answers here. But the conversation itself is important. It makes us examine our assumptions about art, creativity, value, all in the context of this rapidly changing tech landscape.
It really does. It's a necessary recalibration of our thinking.
So pulling this all together as we wrap up, it's clear AI-generated art isn't just some novelty tech demo. It's a major cultural moment.
Yeah, a philosophical shift even. It's really pushing against those traditional human-only views of who gets to create and what counts as art.
And we've seen how that plays out.
Yeah.
The design process becoming this human-machine dialogue.
The definition of creativity itself being stretched and debated.
The surprising links to postmodern ideas of remix and reference.
And how a post-humanist perspective helps us make sense of it all, offering a wider view of creative agency.
It's definitely a space to watch, constantly evolving. And it demands we stay open-minded, willing to wrestle with these big ideas.
Absolutely.
So maybe a final thought to leave our listeners with. Now that we have this algorithmic muse, how do you think our understanding of creativity itself will keep changing? What will be the uniquely human contribution to art in an age where machines can also create?
That's the big question for the next chapter, isn't it? Definitely something to mull over. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, it's really striking how the design world, which, well, it used to feel pretty steady, is just being completely transformed by technology now. It really feels like the ground is shifting.
Yeah, totally.
We've pulled together some different perspectives on this. I mean, everything from really new ways we might interact with devices all the way to how AI is changing, you know, the whole creative process.
Right.
So our goal today really is to give you, the listener, a good, clear sense of the main shifts happening in design right now.
Exactly. I mean, think about it, the old ways of doing things, the standard practices, they're all being questioned. And the stuff we looked at points to some really big changes you should probably be aware of, like more natural ways of interacting coming up.
Okay.
The huge impact of AI, both in how designs get made and how they actually work in the UI.
Right.
A sort of critical look at the tools designers rely on. And maybe the biggest thing, this growing feeling that, you know, the old certainties in design are just kind of evaporating.
Okay, yeah, let's unpack that. Starting with something pretty concrete, how we actually, like, use technology.
Right.
For so long, it's just been keyboard and mouse, hasn't it? Solid, reliable, but maybe, well, maybe a bit restrictive looking back.
Totally. And we're seeing some really interesting alternatives starting to bubble up.
Yeah.
Well, what's really intriguing is the potential for much more intuitive ways to give input, like this concept called wrist power.
Wrist power.
Okay.
Right.
It suggests that maybe in the future, tiny muscle movements in our wrists, they could become a main way we control computers.
Wow. Okay. That's a totally different way of thinking, isn't it?
It is.
Imagine interfaces reacting to these tiny, almost invisible gestures. Designers would suddenly have to think beyond just screens and buttons to actual, like, biomechanics, human bodies. It raises all sorts of questions about ergonomics and how precise could that actually be?
Precisely. It forces a rethink of how we translate what we want to do into digital action, you know, moving past the click and drag we're so used to. And building on that, this idea of more natural interaction. One of the articles from UX Planet really highlights touchless methods becoming more important. Voice, gesture, eye tracking.
Absolutely. And the reasons for that are varied, aren't they? Like simple hygiene benefits.
Sure.
But also trying to create these really seamless, almost invisible experiences. But what really gets you thinking is how it changes the designer's job. It's not just about the 2D screen anymore.
Exactly. And if you zoom out a bit, we're seeing this move from being totally screen focused to more like, well, spatial thinking.
Spatial thinking. Okay.
Yeah. Like think about designing an interaction using a hand gesture in, say, augmented reality.
Right.
That's a completely different design problem than just putting a button on a phone screen. You're dealing with 3D space, the user's body in that space.
So we're moving from interacting with a screen to interacting within a space. That feels significant.
It is.
But then, okay, then you throw generative AI into the mix. That feels like an even bigger earthquake.
Oh.
That UX Matters article, Beyond the Algorithm, really hammered home how big a deal this Gen AI thing is.
This is where it gets really interesting, I think. Because Gen AI isn't just about, like, automating old tasks faster.
Right.
It's changing the very heart of the design process itself.
Yeah.
The classic idea of the designer as the sole creator.
Yeah.
That's really shifting.
It's like we're becoming more like conductors, maybe, leading an AI orchestra.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Our skill becomes guiding the AI, right?
Yeah.
To get it to produce what we envision. And that brings in this whole new skill, prompt engineering.
Crucial.
It's not enough just to have the idea. You need to know how to tell the AI what you want effectively to get something useful back.
Exactly.
Plus, you've got to be able to critically judge what the AI spits out. It's a tool, not magic.
Precisely. Yeah. Our role changes from just pure creation to this mix of, like, guiding, curating, and really critically assessing what the AI comes up with.
Hmm.
Think about how that could speed up rapid prototyping.
Yeah.
Instead of a designer spending ages making multiple versions.
Right. Takes forever.
An AI could generate a whole bunch of variations super quickly. That lets you test and refine ideas much, much faster. It totally changes the speed you can work at.
That speed up and iteration is huge. But it also means, well, we need to really understand what these AI tools can and can't do.
Definitely.
And importantly, be mindful of the, you know, the implications of using AI in creative work. Using it responsibly to boost our skills.
Uh-huh.
The old linear design process seems like it's becoming more of a dynamic conversation between the human and the AI.
Yeah, a feedback loop. And AI's impact isn't just on making designs either. It's also getting huge in personalizing user experiences, which we should definitely get into.
Okay.
But this whole wave of tech change is so big, it's even making us look again at the tools we use every single day.
It's like nothing's safe from this disruption. That article arguing Figma's not a design tool, it's a Rube Goldberg machine for avoiding code.
Hmm.
That definitely makes you stop and think.
Huh, yeah, it's a provocative title.
It is. But it raises a fair point, doesn't it, about how complex these platforms we rely on have become.
Well, what's interesting there is the suggestion that maybe tools like Figma, while amazing for visuals and collaboration.
Yeah, they are.
Maybe they've gotten a bit too complex trying to hide the underlying code. The article sort of hints we might swing back towards a closer link between design and development.
Feels like the pendulum might be swinging back a bit. Not saying every designer needs to be a coding expert.
No, not at all.
But maybe just understanding the tech side better could lead to smoother, more efficient outcomes. Fewer mistakes translating design to code, maybe. A better grasp of the whole picture.
Imagine a future where that handoff between design and dev becomes almost invisible.
Ooh, okay.
Where the design tool can, you know, pretty much directly turn a visual prototype into working code.
Wow.
That would get rid of so much friction.
Right.
And it would give designers more direct control over how their ideas actually get built. Faster iteration, a more joined up approach.
That sounds incredibly efficient.
Yeah.
Less back and forth, quicker results, designers feeling more ownership. Okay, cool. Now, let's shift focus a bit to how AI is directly changing what users actually see and do the UI itself.
Right.
That article, AI is Reshaping UI, had some really clear examples of this happening already.
Yeah, this is where AI's impact is really obvious to the person using the app or website.
Yeah.
We see it all the time, actually.
Like recommendations on Netflix or Spotify.
Exactly. Or dynamic layouts that change based on how you use an app. Or think about AI chatbots handling customer service instantly.
Right. Yeah, that's a very direct AI interface.
Definitely. It's moving beyond just working behind the scenes.
Yeah.
AI is becoming a visible core part of the user experience.
And that again, changes the designer's job, doesn't it? We're not just building static screens anymore. We're designing these adaptive systems that learn and change based on what the user needs.
That AI-powered travel app example really makes it clear. Well, imagine an app that doesn't just show a fixed list of flights. Instead, it dynamically resorts and filters based on your travel history, real-time flight info, maybe even predicts delays at your destination.
Whoa.
That kind of dynamic personalization.
Yeah.
You just couldn't do that with old-school fixed UIs.
It's a move from static and predictable to dynamic and intelligent.
Exactly.
Which means designers need new skills, right? Like maybe getting more familiar with data science, machine learning ideas.
Yeah, at least the basics.
And constantly thinking about the ethics of all this personalization, making sure it helps, not creeps people out.
Absolutely crucial. Which kind of brings us to the big umbrella theme that seems to tie all these different threads together.
Which is?
The end of design certainty. That's how one source put it. In this world where tech, especially AI, is evolving so fast, and we have all these connected devices, and user habits are always shifting, the old fixed design rules just don't seem to apply as strongly anymore.
It's a bit unsettling, maybe, but also kind of freeing. Yeah. The idea that rigid principles aren't the be-all and end-all means we have to be more fluid, more experimental. We can't just follow a checklist.
Think about something like the metaverse.
Okay. Still pretty fuzzy.
Exactly. It's this huge, mostly undefined digital space. Designing for that, where interactions and rules are still being figured out, it demands being okay with ambiguity.
Yeah.
And being ready to adapt constantly as it takes shape.
It's like we're designing the plane while flying it.
Pretty much.
Which means we need different methods, right? More flexibility, always getting user feedback, being ready to pivot quickly when things change.
Absolutely. That idea of aiming for one perfect finished design, it's becoming kind of obsolete. Mm-hmm. We're designing for constant iteration now. Continuous learning, constant evolution. The whole environment is just too dynamic to stand still.
Okay, so let's just quickly recap the main things we've hit on in this deep dive. There's the move to more natural interactions, like wrist control, touchless stuff.
Uh-huh.
The huge impact of generative AI on the design process itself.
Right, the conductor idea.
That critical rethinking of our everyday design tools.
Take them out getting caught.
AI showing up directly in the UI, making things more personalized.
Dynamic interface.
And wrapping it all up, this big theme of design uncertainty, meaning we need to be way more adaptable and experimental.
Yeah.
The whole design landscape is definitely changing in some really big and, yeah, challenging ways.
And I think for you, the listener, the big takeaway here is just how vital continuous learning and adaptation are now.
Absolutely.
To really succeed in design going forward, you've got to embrace these new technologies, not run from them, figure out how to use them smartly to make even better, more user-focused experiences.
Right.
The core principles of good design, understanding users, solving problems, they're still essential.
Mm-hmm.
But the tools, the methods, that's what's undergoing this massive shift.
So as we wrap up, here's maybe one last thought for you to chew on. With AI getting so deeply woven into the design process, how might those lines between the designer as the creator and AI as just the tool start to get, well, really blurry?
Interesting question.
And following on from that, what fundamental skills, the truly human things like empathy, critical judgment, strategic thinking, what skills will stay absolutely essential for designers in the future, even when AI can generate endless options?
Mm-hmm.
Our sources kind of touched on that, but didn't fully answer it. And it feels like a really important thing to think about as we all figure out what design looks like next. Ever feel like technology is evolving faster than you can keep up?
Oh, definitely. You're not alone there.
Yeah, well, today we're diving deep into something called agentification. Sounds a bit technical, maybe, but it's this shift that's really changing how we interact with our digital world, fundamentally changing it.
Absolutely. We're looking at, you know, the rise of these autonomous AI agents. What does that actually mean for how you use technology and, well, for society, too?
And we've got some great material to work from. You shared articles from places like Figma's blog, UX Magazine, Department of Product.
Hmm.
What else? Technology Review, UX Matters.
Right. A good mix.
So think of this as us filtering through all that, pulling out the key stuff for you. Your personalized briefing, if you like.
Yeah, the mission today is really to unpack what agentification actually is, why it matters to you, the listener, and the main things to keep an eye on as this trend picks up steam.
All without drowning in jargon, hopefully.
That's the plan. Keep it clear, keep it relevant.
Okay, so agentification. Let's start there. What are we really talking about? Is it just smarter apps or something more?
It's definitely more. Fundamentally, agentification means moving away from tools that just sit there waiting for you to tell them exactly what to do, step by step.
Right, like most software now. Click here, type this.
Exactly. We're moving towards interacting with proactive AI entities,
Yeah.
agents. They can actually work for you autonomously. You give them goals, not just commands.
Okay, so I don't have to map out every single action. I just say, here's the outcome I want.
Precisely. The agent figures out the how. You know, it's interesting. One of the pieces, the Figma one, is titled Double Click, Human Takes on Agentic AI. That double click kind of suggests
Suggests what? Like faster interaction.
maybe faster, but also maybe more.
Intuitive.
Less about typing out long instructions and more about a direct understanding. Like you click and it gets your intent. That's the feeling it evokes anyway.
Huh. Okay, so like my email. Instead of setting up filters and rules myself, I could just tell an AI agent, look, only bother me with urgent stuff from my boss or family.
That's exactly the kind of thing. And it would ideally learn what urgent means to you
Yeah.
and handle the rest. It's a shift from direct manipulation to collaboration
A
almost.
partnership. You set the goal, it does the legwork.
Yeah, you define the big picture objectives, and the agent takes the initiative to figure out the steps.
Got it. So these aren't just slightly better apps, they're more like digital partners, assistants that can actually think for themselves, hopefully in ways that help us.
That's the idea. Autonomous allies, you could say.
Which brings us to designing them. The UX Magazine article, Demystifying Designing an Agent. Designing an agent must be really different from designing, say, a website, right? What are the big challenges?
Oh, huge differences. That article likely points out you're not just arranging buttons anymore. You're shaping, well, the behavior of something that acts on its own.
Behavior. That sounds complex.
It is. Think about an agent managing your schedule. It's not just at event. It's understand priorities, negotiate conflicts, anticipate travel time, maybe even learn when you're most productive. You're designing its decision-making.
So you need super clear goals for the agent first.
Absolutely. What problem is it solving for the user? What's the desired outcome? Then you have to program how it assesses situations, how it chooses what to do.
And how it tells me what it's doing.
Critically important.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does it communicate its actions, its reasoning back to the user? Because trust is everything here.
Right. If it just does stuff silently in the background.
Exactly. You need some insight. You need to feel confident it's acting in your best interest. It's not like a normal interface where you see everything happen. An agent's work can be invisible until the outcome.
So the design focus shifts massively towards building reliability, trustworthiness, creating a partner you can actually depend on.
Precisely. That's the core challenge.
That makes total sense. You know, if my magic email agent started deleting important client emails because it misunderstood priority, I'd uninstall it immediately.
Of course. The trust would be broken.
So how does this focus on behavior and trust play out in the actual user experience? The Department of Product piece, Deep Dive, the UX of AI assistants must have insights here.
It likely does. As these agents get smarter, our expectations change.
Right.
We expect more. The UX needs to go beyond just being functional.
It needs to build that trust we were talking about.
Yes, build and maintain it. And transparency is key. If an agent makes a big decision, like maybe a finance agent investing your money, you'd probably want to know why it made that choice.
Absolutely. I don't want a black box messing with my finances. No way.
Exactly. So you need that visibility, but also a sense of control. Even if it's autonomous, you need to feel like you can still steer it, tweak its goals, or step in if needed.
So, not total automation, but guided autonomy, something like that. And the help it offers needs to feel natural. Proactive, maybe, but not annoying or creepy. It should anticipate needs without getting in the way.
Proactive support. I mean,
Yeah.
that sounds amazing in theory. Like, if my flight's delayed, the agent just rebooks me instantly before I even know.
That's the dream scenario for some tasks, yeah.
But there have to be downsides, right? Handing over too much autonomy. That technology review article, why handing over total control to AI agents would be a huge mistake, kind of flags that, doesn't it?
It does. And it's a really crucial point. The potential is huge, but that article serves as a necessary warning sign. We need to be careful about giving away too much control, especially in important areas.
Why? What are the risks?
Well, the article probably argues that we need human oversight to keep these agents aligned with our actual goals, our values, things AI might not grasp.
So, okay, for optimizing my calendar, maybe, but not for deciding my career path. Exactly.
Yeah.
Or making critical medical or financial decisions completely unchecked. There's the risk of unforeseen errors, biases baked into the algorithms, things that need a human perspective.
So, full autonomy might be inefficient for some things, but dangerous for others. It's about finding the right balance.
It's all about that balance.
Yeah.
Calibrating the power of autonomy with the wisdom of human judgment. That's going to be the tightrope walk as this tech evolves.
This really does feel like a fundamental change in how we even relate to technology. The UX Matters article, Relationship User Experiences. That title says a lot. It's not just using anymore, it's a relationship.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It's becoming less transactional, you know, command-response.
And more.
More collaborative.
Yeah.
More like a partnership. You communicate your needs, maybe more naturally, conversationally, and the AI takes the initiative to work towards those goals.
So I don't need to be a software expert. I just need to be good at explaining what I want to my digital partner.
That's a big part of it. And this shift means we need to rethink some classic UX ideas. Building trust, understanding,
yeah,
that becomes central.
How do you design for that?
Well, the UX needs to give really clear feedback. What's the agent doing? Why? Let the user see the process, at least to some extent.
And make it easy to jump in.
Crucial. Easy intervention. If you disagree or want to change the goal, it needs to be simple to do that. You're still ultimately in charge.
Okay, wow. There's a lot there. So let's try and synthesize this. For someone trying to get their head around agentification, what are the absolute key takeaways from all these different angles?
Okay, first big one. This isn't just better software. It's a fundamental shift. We're moving from designing interfaces people click on to designing autonomous entities people collaborate with.
Right, designing collaborators, not just tools. That's a big mental shift for designers, I bet.
Huge. Second, it's all about balance. We want the power and efficiency of AI agents, for sure. But we absolutely need to keep human control and oversight, especially for anything high stakes.
Non-negotiable for critical stuff.
Definitely. And third, underpinning all of it, trust and transparency. They're not nice to haves. They're the foundation. Without them, this whole concept doesn't really work in practice.
And it all still has to be user-centered, even if the user is interacting with something autonomous.
Always. The agent's value comes entirely from how well it serves the user's actual needs and intentions.
So that double click idea we started with, it's less about the physical click and more like clicking into a partnership, setting an intention and trusting the agent to run with it collaboratively.
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it. It signals moving away from micromanaging the steps towards setting the direction, a goal-oriented partnership.
So wrapping up then, it's clear this move towards agentification is way more than just a buzzword.
Oh yeah, it's a real shift.
It's fundamentally changing how we're going to work with tech, rely on tech. These sources you shared, they really highlight the amazing potential, more intuitive, maybe more seamless interactions.
But also the absolute need for really thoughtful design. Design that builds in trust, transparency, and keeps humans in the loop where it counts.
Okay, so here's a thought to leave people with. Thinking about your own life, your own tech habits, what's one task you'd actually be excited to hand over to a truly reliable AI agent?
Interesting question. And the flip side, what's one area where you'd say, nope, absolutely not, I need full control here?
Yeah. Thinking about that difference, that personal line, that's kind of where the future of these autonomous allies will be shaped, isn't it? By those individual and collective decisions.
Exactly. It's where the rubber meets the road.
Well, this deep dive, as always, just scratches the surface. There's so much more to unpack as this all unfolds.
We're moving fast.
But hopefully this has given everyone a clearer picture, a better handle on this really significant shift happening in our digital world.
You know how it is. There's always some new buzzword, right, floating around, promising the world.
Yeah.
And you want to get a handle on it, forget what it really means. But who has time for, like, hours of dense reading?
Exactly.
That's why you're here. Today, we're diving deep into something called vibe coding.
Yeah, vibe coding. It's definitely popping up more in talks about, you know, the future of software development.
Right.
So essentially, the core idea is maybe creating software becomes less about writing all that detailed code and more about just expressing an intention or maybe a desired outcome, almost like setting a mood or a vibe.
A vibe, right.
We've been looking at stuff from Figma, Department of Product, UX Planet, UXdesign.cc, trying to get the full picture.
Okay, good range.
Yeah.
So let's try and nail down what this vibe coding thing actually is then.
Right.
From what I'm seeing, it sounds like translating what you want the software to do directly into, well, reality.
Mm-hmm. Often using like intuitive interfaces.
Mm.
And AI is key.
Yeah, AI seems huge here. Figma mentioned that double-click idea, you know, designed straight to a working feature.
Yeah, and Department of Product talks about a more intuitive flow for development.
So the big promise, it seems, is that maybe designers or even folks who aren't, you know, traditional programmers,
right,
they could start actually building software more easily. Is that the gist?
That's definitely the core appeal, yeah. Lowering that technical barrier, making it more accessible.
Okay.
But, you know, that immediately brings up a pretty critical question for everyone listening.
Mm.
If AI can just take these intentions, these vibes, and churn out working code, well, what happens to all that deep expertise?
Right. The expertise software engineers bring to the table.
Exactly. Where does that fit in?
Okay, let's unpack that AI piece a bit more then.
Because
it really does seem like the driving force behind all this.
Totally. It enables the whole concept.
The UX Planet article, you mentioned that one. It talks about cursor AI.
Yeah, things like translating natural language, just typing what you want straight into code.
Wow.
And AI just generating chunks of code automatically.
So it sounds like maybe that really detailed knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, specific programming languages or how to structure data efficiently.
Data structures, algorithms.
Yeah, really fundamental technical stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe it becomes less central. Is that the implication?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? If the AI handles the, let's say, the syntax, the grammar of code, as UX Planet kind of suggests, you really have to wonder, right? Will the demand for engineers with that deep foundational computer science knowledge, will it shrink?
Will their specific expertise in those underlying technical bits become less critical?
It's a potential shift, yeah. Definitely something to think about.
It really is. But then, okay, another big question just pops in my head. And I'm sure you're thinking it too.
Go on.
If we're relying more on these sort of intuitive inputs, these vibes, and AI is writing the code, what does that actually do to the quality of the software?
Ah, yes. Quality. That's crucial.
I mean, the UXdesign.cc article mentioned maintainability, right?
Yeah.
How easy it is to update and fix later.
And scalability. Yeah. Handling growth.
But I'm thinking even more basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, will this software be reliable? Will it actually work consistently? Will it be secure from, you know, hackers?
Yeah.
And will it perform well? Will it be fast enough for users?
Those are the fundamental pillars, aren't they? Robustness, security, performance.
Exactly. So we've talked about the promise, the allure.
Yeah.
Let's maybe turn a more critical eye now. What about reliability or robustness?
Yeah, robustness. That's a great place to start because it's not just about making software that basically works under perfect conditions.
Right.
Real quality means it can handle the unexpected. Errors, weird inputs, network drops. Without just falling over.
And engineers spend a lot of time thinking about that stuff, don't they? Those edge cases.
Absolutely. Anticipating what could go wrong. Trying to build in resilience.
So can an AI that's just interpreting a general intention, like a vibe, can it really have that same foresight, that level of detail?
It's hard to see how, right? Intuitively generated code. It feels like it might lack that really comprehensive error handling.
Because the initial vibe probably didn't specify and handle these 50 weird error conditions.
Precisely. It's often not explicit in the initial high-level request.
Okay, so robustness is one big question mark. What about security? That feels even scarier.
Hugely important. Engineers are, or should be, trained to spot potential vulnerabilities, to follow secure coding practices, you know, actively preventing ways bad actors could exploit the software.
Right, building defenses in from the start.
So can we really just assume that an AI, especially one guided by maybe non-expert input, like someone focused purely on the look and feel, will automatically produce secure code?
Doesn't seem likely, does it?
The risk of unintentionally baking in security flaws, it seems like it would have to be higher, right, if that deep security knowledge isn't driving the process.
Yeah, you could end up with something that looks great, feels right, but is wide open to attack.
Think about common things like injection attacks, ways hackers trick the software. Experienced engineers know the patterns to watch for and prevent. Will an AI translating a vibe have that same built-in caution, that awareness? It's a big ask.
It really is. It feels like security is almost a reflex for experienced developers. It's not just make it work, it's make it work safely.
Exactly. And then there's performance.
Yeah. Speed. Making things run efficiently.
Engineers often spend ages optimizing code, right? Squeezing out every bit of performance so apps load fast, respond instantly.
We've all used slow websites or apps. It's frustrating.
Terribly frustrating. So will software that's kind of vibe coded, will it be as lean and fast?
Or could it end up being bloated, resource hungry, because maybe it lacks that deep understanding of how the computer actually processes things efficiently.
That's the concern. Performance isn't just a nice to have, it's core to the user experience.
Yeah.
Slow software is bad software, often.
And that inefficiency might stem from code that, well, got the vibe right, but didn't understand the optimal way to implement it under the hood.
Precisely. And that connects to another point. Testability.
Ooh, testing.
Yeah.
How do you make sure it actually works correctly?
Well, in traditional development, writing tests like automated checks is absolutely fundamental.
Right. Unit tests, integration tests, all that stuff to catch bugs.
Exactly. So how do you properly test software that was created more from a general feeling, a vibe?
Rather than a structured, engineered process with clear components.
Yeah. If it lacks that clear structure, that sort of well-defined architecture.
How do you even write meaningful tests for it? It sounds difficult, like trying to test a blob of clay versus testing engineered parts.
That's a good analogy. You might lose that roadmap for verification, that ability to systematically check each piece.
Okay, so testing could be a real challenge.
And this loops right back to those concerns from UXdesign.cc about maintainability and scalability.
Right, keeping it running and growing it over time.
If you don't have that traditional engineering rigor, like a clear system design, a consistent coding style everyone follows, good documentation explaining what's going on, then trying to maintain that code, fix bugs, add features later, it becomes incredibly difficult, maybe even impossible.
Oh, I can just picture it. Trying to dive back into code that was generated based on someone's vibe 6 months ago.
Nightmare fuel for developers.
And then trying to scale it up.
Yeah.
Like way more users. Or much more complex features.
If that solid engineering foundation isn't there from the start,
yeah,
you could hit a wall really fast. Major problem.
It reminds me of like building a house. You can have a cool idea, a vibe for the house,
mm-hmm.
but you still need the architect and the structural engineer to make the actual blueprints, right? To make sure it won't fall down.
That's a perfect analogy. The initial sketch versus the detailed engineering plans.
The vibe gets you started, but the engineering makes it robust, safe, and lasting.
Exactly. And it feels like the same applies here. That detailed planning, the consideration for structure, for longevity, it's crucial for software too.
So, okay. While the idea of vibe coding making things faster, more accessible, it is appealing, no doubt.
It definitely is.
But it feels like there's a significant trade-off happening, or potentially happening.
Yeah.
We might be sacrificing that really crucial engineering expertise, the stuff that ensures software is actually reliable, secure, fast, and sustainable long term.
I think that's the core tension, absolutely. It's vital to see AI in this context as a tool, a potentially powerful one,
right?
But one that should probably augment human expertise, not just completely replace it.
Because the role of a good software engineer,
yeah,
it's so much more than just typing code, isn't it?
Oh, way more. It's about understanding the actual problem first.
Problem analysis, yeah.
Designing the whole system architecture, planning how all the pieces fit together, thinking about security from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Optimizing for performance.
And rigorous testing, making sure it truly meets the quality bar.
These are really complex tasks, right? They need deep understanding, critical thinking.
Things that an AI just translating a general vibe, well, it's probably not going to replicate that easily, if at all.
And these are the things that actually lead to high-quality software that lasts.
Exactly. And that application of deep knowledge, that critical thought process, that's why skilled software engineers are still, I believe, indispensable, especially for the complex systems we rely on.
Okay. So wrapping up this deep dive then.
Mm-hmm.
It really feels like we've landed on this key tension.
Mm-hmm.
On one side, you've got the exciting promise of vibe coding speed, intuition, maybe more people creating things, democratization.
The lore is strong, yeah.
But on the other side, there's this fundamental enduring need for solid engineering principles, for the nuanced expertise engineers bring to ensure quality, security, performance, maintainability. All of it.
Precisely. The vision of making software creation easier is compelling, absolutely.
Yeah.
But we have to stay clear-eyed about the potential risks.
Yeah.
Risks to the robustness, the reliability of the digital world we increasingly depend on.
And the role of the thoughtful, skilled engineer in sort of safeguarding that quality.
Yeah.
It seems more important than ever, really.
I'd argue so, yes. Paramount.
It definitely gives you something to chew on. So here's a final thought for everyone listening.
Mm-hmm.
Where else do you see this kind of balance being tested? This tension between, say, intuitive creation or super fast results and the potentially hidden cost of losing deep expertise or established principles? Think beyond software. Are there other fields where this promise of easier access might have unforeseen consequences for quality or for how we value specialized knowledge?
That's a great question to ponder.
Yeah, something to reflect on in your own areas of interest. Until our next deep dive, keep exploring, keep questioning.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really interesting shift we're seeing in the professional world.
Mm.
It's this increasing value of having a broad skill set, you know, of being a generalist in a world that often, well, champions hyper-specialization.
Right. Super-focused roles.
Exactly. So think of this as your inside track to understanding how to really navigate and thrive in a constantly evolving career landscape, something we know is pretty crucial for you, our listeners.
That's right. And we've gathered a, well, a compelling set of sources to explore this. We'll be looking at insights from what we can gather from some pasted text, maybe notes from an industry chat or something.
Could be.
Alongside articles like Duolingo just ended the term UX design, UX or PX, why naming matters, the Figma blog post, the rise of the generalist, the Nielsen Norman Group's article, Return of the UX Generalist, and UXdesign.cc's piece, A Bright Future for Strategic Thinkers.
Wow. Okay. So quite a few angles here.
Yeah. It's a really diverse collection. It paints quite a picture of this this evolving trend.
So our goal in this deep dive is to really pull out the core reasons behind this, you know, growing prominence of the generalist approach. And most importantly, what it means for you, for anyone who's committed to continuous learning and staying ahead of the curve. Okay, so let's dive in.
Let's do it.
That pasted text we looked at first, it seems to suggest a real challenge to the traditional idea of the, like, the ultra-specialized expert.
The deep diver.
Yeah, the person who knows an incredible amount about one very narrow field. It hints at a move towards professionals who can connect different areas of knowledge.
And what's particularly insightful in that initial perspective, I think, is the idea of needing to traverse boundaries.
Right.
It really highlights the shift from working within, you know, clearly defined silos to needing professionals who can move between disciplines, understand different perspectives, and sort of bring those together in new ways.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it, about your own experiences? Like, when you're tackling complex projects or even just navigating daily work, how often does that ability to bridge different areas really come into play?
All the time. Probably more than we realize.
Yeah. Now, a really tangible example of this shift in action comes from Duolingo. That article, Duolingo just ended the term UX design, it details their decision to actually, like, eliminate that specific job title.
Yeah, and their reasoning offers a really clear illustration of this whole trend. It wasn't just about changing a label, you know?
Right.
The article indicates that the traditional UX design title simply wasn't broad enough anymore to reflect the diverse skills and responsibilities their design team actually needed to handle. They found their designers were contributing in a, well, a much wider capacity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The article points out these expanded responsibilities now include things like influencing product strategy, conducting user research, which, okay, makes sense for UX, but also diving into interaction design, visual design, and even understanding the underlying tech in the overall business objectives.
That's a big jump.
It really is. That's a significant expansion beyond a purely user-focused role, wouldn't you say? It really underscores this need for a much broader understanding. And for our listeners, understanding this kind of evolution is exactly why we're doing this deep dive.
It's a prime example, really, how the demands on design pros and likely professionals in many other fields, too, are just becoming increasingly multifaceted.
Right.
And following on from that, we see this interesting evolution in the language itself.
Yeah.
Right? With the move from user experience UX to product experience PX.
Ah, yes. The UX versus PX thing.
Yeah. As explored in UX or PX, why naming matters. It might seem like, oh, just a subtle change, but it reflects a pretty significant shift in perspective.
Absolutely. It's definitely more than just rebranding. The article makes it clear that this move from UX to PX signifies a real broadening of a designer's, like, their whole remit. UX often focus quite intently on the direct interaction a user had with a specific interface, right? Like the screen they're looking at.
Precisely. But PX adopts a far more holistic viewpoint.
Yeah.
It considers the entire user journey.
The whole thing.
Everything.
Yeah.
From their initial awareness of the product, maybe seeing an ad, right through to their long-term engagement, and even, like, their potential to become advocates for it.
Wow.
This includes touch points like marketing materials, the initial onboarding process, even interactions with customer support down the line.
So it's no longer just about making the buttons look good and work smoothly then.
Not at all.
It's about the entire experience a user has with the product end to end. And that naturally requires a much more generalist skill set. You need
Definitely.
to understand not just core design principles, but also have a grasp of, say, marketing concepts, user psychology across different touch points, and how all these bits integrate within the larger product ecosystem.
Which brings us nicely to the Figma blog post, The Rise of the Generalist. Now, we don't have the full text right here, but we can probably infer some of their key arguments based on these other trends we're seeing.
Okay, what do you reckon they're saying?
Well, it likely emphasizes this increasing complexity of digital products as a major driving force.
Right. I mean, when you think about modern apps and platforms, they're rarely simple single-feature tools anymore, are they?
No way.
They're often intricate systems, tons of features, diverse user workflows, the expectation of seamless function across like phones, tablets, desktops, everywhere.
It stands to reason that a designer operating in that kind of environment would need a broader understanding from the initial user research all the way through to information architecture, the visual stuff, how it all fits technically.
And beyond just the product itself, the increasing prevalence of cross-functional teams is likely another key point in Figma's perspective. Designers today, they rarely work in a vacuum.
They're collaborating really closely with engineers, product managers, marketers. To be truly effective there, you need to understand their perspectives, their constraints, how your decisions impact their work.
That necessitates a generalist approach, then, doesn't it? Being able to talk the talk across different professional domains.
Exactly. Communicate and collaborate effectively.
That makes total sense. And the rapid pace of technological change must also be a factor, right?
Oh, for sure.
Generalists, with their wider base of knowledge and skills, they might just be inherently more adaptable to new tools and tech as it pops up.
Yeah, that's a good point. They're perhaps not as deeply wedded to one specific tool set or methodology, maybe, making it easier to pivot and learn new things.
Their flexibility becomes a real advantage in a landscape that's, let's face it, constantly shifting under our feet.
Absolutely. Now, the Nielsen-Norman Group, NNG, with their article Return of the UX Generalists, they offer an interesting angle by framing this as a return.
A return, implying it's been here before.
Kind of, yeah. It suggests a cyclical nature,
Yeah.
implying that perhaps there was a period where deep specialization was the dominant model, maybe in the earlier days of UX maturity.
Okay.
And now we're seeing a renewed appreciation for the value of a more general approach within UX.
That's a really insightful way to look at it, like the pendulum swinging back, maybe.
Sort of, yeah.
So, what do you think are the driving forces behind this return, according to NNG's likely arguments?
Well, they probably contend that generalists possess this unique ability to synthesize information from a whole variety of sources
No, okay.
because they have that broader understanding of different facets of the user experience, the research, the design, the business context, the tech. They can connect seemingly disparate pieces of information more effectively than someone with a very narrow focus.
So they're the ones who can kind of step back and see the bigger picture, understanding how all the individual bits contribute to the overall whole. That resonates. You can imagine a specialist being incredibly skilled in one specific area, but potentially missing how that area interacts with and impacts, other parts of the user journey.
Precisely. NNG likely emphasizes the generalist capacity to identify opportunities for innovation or maybe potential pain points that a specialist might just overlook because their focus is naturally more limited.
Right, they're zoomed in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It really underscores the inherent value of having that holistic perspective when you're tackling complex user experience challenges.
Okay, now let's shift focus just slightly to strategic thinking. The UXdesign.cc article, A Bright Future for Strategic Thinkers, highlights another crucial dimension of this whole generalism trend.
Yeah, it's not just about having lots of different skills, is it?
No, it's about the ability to apply that knowledge strategically.
Exactly. The article likely argues that designers are increasingly expected to contribute to the overarching product strategy and, the business objectives.
So moving beyond just execution.
Way beyond just executing on a predefined set of requirements, there's this growing expectation that they'll bring a strategic mindset to the table. Ask the why, not just the how.
And to contribute strategically, you'd need to understand a whole range of factors that might traditionally fall outside the purview of a highly specialized designer, right?
Sure.
Things like having a solid grasp of the target market, deeply understanding user needs on a fundamental level, grasping the intricacies of business models, even analyzing the competitive landscape.
All of those areas basically necessitate a generalist perspective.
Yep.
You need to be able to connect your design decisions not just to usability and aesthetics, which are important,
of course,
but also to tangible business outcomes.
Yeah.
That ability to think strategically, to see how design impacts the larger organizational goals, is becoming incredibly valuable.
And it inherently relies on having that broader knowledge base and the capacity to, like we said before, synthesize information from different domains.
Absolutely.
So it's not just about being a jack of all trades in terms of skills, but also about being able to think across different levels from the tiny design details up to the big picture business strategy.
Well put.
And it sounds like this isn't just happening in design, is it?
No, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our initial pasted text also kind of touched upon this, suggesting that this shift towards generalism is a broader trend observed across various professional fields.
Why do you think that is?
Well, the increasing interconnectedness of industries, for one, and just the inherently complex nature of modern challenges, think climate change, public health, AI ethics.
Big, messy problems.
Exactly. Yeah. They often require individuals who can integrate knowledge from multiple areas to even begin to develop effective solutions.
It makes perfect sense. Tackling any significant challenge today, it rarely fits neatly within the boundaries of just one discipline, does it?
Not anymore.
You need people who can synthesize information from diverse fields, collaborate effectively with teams made up of varied expertise, and crucially, possess the adaptability to adjust as the situation evolves.
And those are all defining characteristics of a generalist approach, aren't they?
Yeah. That capacity to synthesize effectively, collaborate seamlessly across different teams, adapt readily to rapid change. These are becoming universally valued skills.
Absolutely. So, considering all of this, pulling it all together, what are the key takeaways for you, our listener?
Well, it seems, abundantly clear from these various perspectives that the future increasingly favors individuals who possess a broad range of skills,
mm-hmm.
who can effectively connect different areas of knowledge, and who can adopt that crucial holistic perspective.
Right. And it's important to reiterate, this isn't about saying deep expertise is becoming obsolete.
Yeah, well, not at all. Deep knowledge is still vital.
But it is about recognizing the growing significance of versatility
mm-hmm.
and that ability to see how all the different pieces of the puzzle fit together.
And the evidence supporting this trend is pretty compelling, isn't it?
I think so. From the evolving language used to describe roles in design, UX to PX, the dropping of old titles, to the explicit recognition of generalist value in publications from, Figma's blog to NNG's insights.
Yeah.
The shift seems pretty undeniable. The professional landscape is just evolving in a way that rewards those who can confidently, as that text said, traverse boundaries and effectively synthesize information from diverse sources.
So here's a final thought to maybe mull over. Reflect on the skills and knowledge you are currently developing. How can you consciously work to broaden your perspective?
Good question.
How can you start actively connecting seemingly unrelated areas of interest? What new boundaries could you explore and bridge to truly position yourself for this evolving future?
It's not just about keeping pace with change.
No, it's about getting ahead by cultivating that essential ability to see the bigger picture. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. It really is almost strange, isn't it? Thinking back just a few years, AI felt like pure science fiction.
Right. Far off.
And now it's just everywhere. In our emails, writing stuff for us, part of daily life.
Absolutely.
But what if this is, just the start? We've been looking at some really interesting material that suggests something bigger is coming.
Mm-hmm.
A convergence, really. We're talking AI, quantum computing, and this idea called public intelligence.
Exactly. And the sources we have here, they're not just talking about things getting a bit faster or smarter. It's pointing towards a really fundamental shift.
A transformation in how we even think about intelligence, about computation itself.
That's the core idea. It's the combination, the synergy between these things that looks so potent.
Okay, so let's unpack that, starting with AI, because that's what we're living through right now.
Right.
It's pretty amazing how fast it's moved from being this niche academic thing to, having this undeniable impact.
It really is. The evolution is intense.
And the sources really hit on that speed, don't they? Mentioning how these models, like ChatGPT, which seemed revolutionary and costly, are already being leapfrogged.
Yeah, by models like DeepSeek, more powerful, and sometimes surprisingly cheaper to run.
It feels like a genuine race. A high stakes one.
Or definitely a competitive race, as the material puts it, with pretty profound implications down the line.
And it's driving this accessibility, right? It's not just locked away in labs anymore.
Exactly. That democratization is key. It means more people, more businesses can actually use these tools.
Which fuels adoption, changes how work gets done.
Across basically every sector.
And the sources are pretty clear. This isn't just about, you know, asking a chatbot for a recipe. It's embedding deeper.
Much deeper. Into workflows, into decision making.
With that potential for automating tasks and, yeah, the tricky subject of job displacement, that looms large.
It does. You can't really talk about this level of automation without considering the economic shifts, the impact on work itself. It forces some big questions.
Right. How do people adapt? How does society manage that transition?
Those are the critical conversations we need to be having.
Okay, so just as we're kind of getting our heads around this AI wave,
mm-hmm.
the sources throw in the next curveball, quantum computing.
The next potential disruption, yeah.
And it's framed as something that could overcome the current limits on AI, right? The hardware bottlenecks.
Exactly. Think of it like current AI is running on incredibly fast, but still conventional, roads.
Okay.
Quantum computing is like building a completely different kind of vehicle, one that doesn't need roads in the same way, potentially.
Uh-huh.
It operates on fundamentally different principles.
Using qubits instead of bits. That's the core difference.
That's the essence of it.
Yeah.
Classical bits are zero or one qubits. Oh, they can be zero, one, or a superposition of both, sort of, both at the same time.
Which lets them tackle certain problems. How much faster?
Exponentially faster.
Mm-hmm.
For specific types of calculations, the difference is just staggering compared to even the best supercomputers we have now.
Yeah. And that's the link to AI. That kind of power could just unlock things.
Precisely. Training models faster, handling much more complex data, simulations.
Yeah.
Things that are currently out of reach.
And the material makes a point that this isn't just theory anymore.
No, definitely not. Google, Microsoft, Amazon, all the big players are pouring resources into building actual quantum chips.
So it's moving from physics labs into engineering.
Tangible technology. That shift is significant.
Yeah.
And the potential applications the sources list are, well, huge.
Like near real-time AI learning. That sounds game-changing.
It would be. Plus breaking current encryption, which is a massive security implication, obviously.
Yeah, double-edged sword there.
And then accelerating drug discovery, financial modeling, material science. The list goes on.
The sources use phrases like unlocking entirely new levels of intelligence. It's not just incremental.
No, it's positioned as a leap, a qualitative change in what's computationally possible, not just doing the same things a bit faster.
Imagine simulations we can't even dream of running today.
Or solving optimization problems that would take a classical computer longer than the age of the universe.
Right.
Quantum could potentially handle those.
Okay, so massive AI potential, turbocharged by quantum. But then there's this other piece, the Model Context Protocol, MCP.
Right, the connective tissue.
The sources present it as the thing that actually links AI to the real world, like giving the brain senses and hands.
That's a great way to put it, because large language models, for all their text smarts, they don't inherently grasp real world context, right? Their knowledge is limited to their training data.
Trapped in the text.
Pretty much. MCP is designed as a kind of standardized framework, a common language almost.
To let AI models connect to
External beta tools?
Exactly. Databases, specialized software, APIs, other digital resources. It defines the rules, the message format, so they can talk to each other reliably.
Like a universal translator and toolkit for AIs.
Sort of, yeah. Sure. Think of it less like bespoke one-off connections, which were clunky and hard to manage.
Right. Custom coding for everything. And more like a standard plug, like USB-C for AI agents. Makes it much easier to connect things.
And the examples given are pretty practical verifying data across different places, automating complex workflows.
Things that require accessing multiple systems or tools in a sequence. MCP streamlines that whole process.
So instead of just generating text, AI agents could actually do more complex tasks in the digital world.
Precisely. Access information, use tools, complete multi-step processes. It makes them far more capable and actually useful in day-to-day work.
The sources say it paves the way for AI agents that are far more integrated. That feels key.
It is. Integrated into our lives, our professional processes. Agents that don't just chat, but act. Securely and reliably, thanks to the standardization.
Okay, this is building quite a picture. Powerful AI, maybe quantum boosted, now connected to the world via MCP. And that leads to this vision of public intelligence.
Yes. This is where it gets really visionary.
The text describes it as a globally accessible and collaborative AI, almost like the internet's original promise.
That's the analogy they draw. Open source ideals, non-commercial, available to everyone, not owned by one company.
But powered by many, an AI of AIs.
Running on open protocols,
Right.
potentially becoming a kind of global commons, a public utility for intelligence.
Wow, that's a big idea.
It really is. It suggests a fundamental shift away from siloed proprietary AI towards something shared.
And how would people access it? The material mentions nominal fees.
Yeah, the idea floated is low-cost access for individuals to this massive pool of knowledge and computing power.
But also, you could contribute data, insights.
That seems to be part of the vision, a distributed system where people can both draw from it and add to it, making it collectively smarter.
Like a global brain constantly learning.
And trained potentially on all of human knowledge, but also able to integrate real-time planetary scale data.
Like environmental sensors, local info, all feeding into this central intelligence.
Imagine the possibilities for understanding complex systems. The sources point directly at tackling global challenges.
Climate change, health crises, using this public intelligence to find solutions with unprecedented scale and insight.
By pooling all that data and computational power, maybe enhanced by quantum, you could model, simulate, and find solutions that are simply impossible right now.
Okay, let's tie it all together then. We've got AI getting smarter. We've got MCP letting it connect and act.
Right.
So those MCP-enabled AI agents become what? Like worker bees for the public intelligence?
That's a decent analogy. They could be the crucial building blocks, accessing data, interacting with the world, feeding insights back into the collective intelligence.
And maybe helping individuals tap into it too, like personal guides.
Potentially, yes. Your interface to this vast network.
And then you layer quantum computing on top of that.
And it just amplifies everything, the processing power for the core public intelligence, the capabilities of the individual agents.
The examples are stark quantum-powered climate models within this public intelligence, or supercharging drug discovery for global health.
It takes an already powerful concept and adds, well, a rocket booster, as you said earlier. It makes those grand challenges seem more tractable.
It's a compelling future, but also maybe a bit overwhelming. The sources then shift focus to navigating all this.
Which is crucial, because these aren't small changes.
No, the text talks about adaptation and strategic positioning,
Yeah.
and those economic shifts, winners and losers, that's sobering.
It is. Major technological leaps always create disruption. The advice given seems sensible. Educate yourself.
Learn about this stuff.
Invest strategically, if that's your sphere. And critically, learn to use AI as a tool. Don't get left behind.
Yeah, there's a warning for businesses, isn't there? Adapt or risk becoming obsolete.
Integration seems key, finding ways to leverage these tools effectively.
And for individuals, the rise of these intelligent agents means new ways of working.
Almost certainly. New forms of work, new collaborations between humans and AI, which points towards lifelong learning being more important than ever.
Constantly adapting your skills.
Right. Staying relevant as the technology evolves.
So, the picture painted has these huge opportunities, but also significant challenges. The text is pretty balanced on that.
It has to be. It mentions equitable access. How do we ensure everyone benefits?
And ethical concerns, AI bias, data privacy, those don't go away.
If anything, they become more critical at this scale, plus navigating those economic disruptions we mentioned.
But on the flip side, the potential upsides are enormous.
Huge efficiencies, scientific breakthroughs we can barely imagine, hyper-personalized services.
And this global intelligence tackling the big stuff, it's this massive potential benefit package.
Exactly. Transformative potential, but it requires careful navigation, preparedness, thoughtful planning.
So, wrapping this deep dive up, the main takeaway feels like this isn't science fiction anymore, or at least it's rapidly moving out of that realm.
The convergence is key. AI, quantum, connected intelligence via protocols like MCP. They aren't separate trends anymore. They're weaving together.
Creating the foundation for a, well, fundamentally different tech future, a rapidly approaching reality.
That's the sense you get. And protocols like MCP are the practical steps, the plumbing being laid right now for that more interconnected world.
And that vision of public intelligence, while maybe ambitious, is compelling, isn't it? The idea of guiding all this power for collective good.
It offers a positive direction, a goal beyond just faster processing or smarter algorithms, a potential purpose.
It does feel like a potential next stage, almost like what the internet could have been, or maybe still could be.
It raises that hope, definitely. But also the question of how. How do we ensure it develops equitably, ethically?
Absolutely. Which leads us to the final thought for our listeners. As you think about this future taking shape, what do you think will be the most crucial factors?
What determines whether we get a truly beneficial, globally accessible public intelligence?
And what's the role of individual people, individual choices, and ethical frameworks in making that happen? Definitely something to mull over.
Indeed.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Conclusion: Navigating the Interwoven Future. The threads woven throughout these pages reveal a profound and multifaceted transformation of our digital and cognitive landscapes. We stand at a critical juncture where the familiar echoes of a once-open internet are fading, replaced by a complex interplay of commercial forces and algorithmic control. The rise of artificial intelligence, while promising groundbreaking advancements, presents a critical session for humanity, demanding a conscious and human-centered approach to prevent its inherent downsides from overshadowing our autonomy and societal equity. The cognitive impact of AI is a central theme, forcing us to confront the delicate balance between the allure of convenience and the potential atrophy of our own mental faculties. The choices designers make today, between automation and augmentation, will profoundly shape the future of human expertise and emotional well-being. Simultaneously, the emergence of AI-generated art challenges our fundamental notions of creativity and authorship, pushing us into a post-humanist era where the boundaries between human and machine ingenuity blur. The very practice of design is undergoing a radical metamorphosis, embracing new interaction paradigms and questioning the efficacy of traditional tools. As AI evolves into autonomous agents, acting on our behalf, and vibe coding hints at a democratization of software development, new design principles centered on trust, transparency, and ethical considerations become paramount. In this rapidly evolving environment, the future belongs to the generalists, those who can traverse disciplinary boundaries and synthesize knowledge to navigate the increasing complexity of our interconnected world. Finally, the horizon is illuminated by the transformative potential of decentralized public intelligence and the unprecedented computational power of quantum computing. While promising democratized AI and revolutionary breakthroughs, these technologies also introduce significant challenges concerning copyright, privacy, and security. As we stand on the precipice of this interwoven future, the fundamental question remains: how will humanity consciously shape these powerful forces to create a world that truly enhances our collective intelligence and fosters genuine human flourishing? The next chapter is ours to write.